As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, today if you wander through New York City's idyllic Greenwich Village, you may come across a small, quiet gathering of people at the corner of the Ash Building, which is located at the intersection of Green Street and Washington Place. And contemplatively, they study a memorial installed on the building's facade, which is dedicated to the 146 garment workers who lost their lives when a fire broke out on this site on March 25th, 1911.
And in anticipation of the 113th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, which is just a few days away from now, this week we bring you a two-part episode that promises to be a tad more somber than we usually do on the show. But for the last six seasons, we have been very remiss in not covering an incredibly pivotal event in American history.
Yes, and this tragic event became a rallying cry for workers' rights activists and the subsequent creation of worker protection legislation in the United States, or the expansion of it, we should say. And while we certainly love celebrating the beauty and art of fashion history, sometimes it's also very important to address the all-too-problematic nature of garment production and consumption, especially as these sorts of abuses and human rights violations, as we will discuss today, are not just part of history, but remain very much part of fashion's present and future.
So in remembrance of the 146 souls lost in the Triangle Fire, in part one, we are going to give an overview of how the American garment industry functioned around the turn of the century and how the systemic abuses inherent to the trade led to the conditions that created the Triangle Fire. And in part two of this episode, we are going to speak about the fire itself. We're going to hear firsthand accounts by some of the survivors, and on a more positive note, learn about how the tragedy inspired sweeping changes, as April just spoke to, in labor reform for not only American garment workers, but also hundreds of thousands of fellow factory workers working in various other industries across the U.S.
Yes, and even though this is a two-parter this week, I'd also just like to note that we're going to be painting this picture in very broad strokes. Cass, as you know, you and I were talking about how this event and all of these much larger issues surrounding it are very complex, so much so that it was hard to wrangle it, all of this information into even two episodes. I was saying, you know, this could be an entire podcast series entirely, honestly, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody has already done this, to be honest. But this week, you're going to get the big picture from us. But anyone wanting more in-depth information about this moment in American history, we are going to provide links to both print and some really wonderful online resources in our show notes. And also, I just want to mention that there are several feature-length documentaries on the Triangle Factory Fire. There are so many books out there written by scholars who have studied the fire's lasting impact on the garment industry. And a lot of them have studied it from various different angles, including women's studies, labor reform, and macroeconomics. So there's also some fantastic websites out there dedicated to this event. And we're going to link to all of this in our show notes. So I digress a bit. Today, we're going to set the scene leading up to the fire by exploring the inner workings of New York City's rag trade, as it was sometimes called.
Yes, and more specifically, we're going to look at the rise of American garment manufacturing as an industry. So in 1791, during his tenure as the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, yes, that Hamilton, published a study. I know I had some songs going in my head just now. But Alexander Hamilton published a study estimating that 2/3 or even up to 4/5 of all clothing made in the newly minted United States was made by hand at home. So clothing production in the 18th and early 19th centuries in America was very much a homegrown and made affair, what we would call a cottage industry. And it's really not until around the 1850s that we begin to see this dramatic shift in not just how clothing is made, but where. So this is a time when we really see mass-produced ready-to-wear garments hit the mainstream market. And what prompted this shift, you ask? Most of you already probably have a pretty good guess, but we're going to tell you anyways.
Yes, enter stage left, the sewing machine. The first commercially viable lock-stitch sewing machines entered the market in the 1840s. The evolution of the sewing machine is actually earlier than this. I think we've done an entire episode on this already. When these lock-stitch sewing machines entered the market, it kind of revolutionized not only at-home sewing, but also created additional opportunities for the mass production of garments on an industrial scale. So hand in hand with switching from this made-to-measure, at-home, cottage model to the factory-based, ready-to-wear model also ushered in standardized sizing. But we're not going to delve into the history of standardized sizing today. We have talked about it a bit on the show in the past, but we should probably just do another episode on it at some point, Cass. It's very, very fascinating. But let's just establish very loosely that the mass production of standard-sized military uniforms during the American Civil War in the 1860s. Well, this is one of the things that gave the industry the nudge it needed to develop this concept of standardized sizing even further. And fashion basically never looked back.
No, it did not. And I just want to emphasize something that April mentioned there too, is just that you're switching from that homegrown cottage industry into these factories. So all of these, and a lot of women, especially in the garment industry, are going, hundreds and thousands of women are going into factories. And of course, we're going to talk a little bit more about that because right along their side there is human rights violations almost immediately. But because we see this, you know, the Industrial Revolution is breeding this innovation and change with things like the standardization and commercialization of the sewing machine, we're seeing the mass manufacturing of goods and we need a place to put those goods. So hand in hand with that is the rise of the department store, which is operating on the rather new model of selling much higher volumes of goods that are suddenly really available at only slightly lower prices. The retail model of the department store relied on a constant ravenous infusion of new stock. Does this sound familiar to us today? Which faster and even cheaper industrial mass production made possible, right? Initially, garments that did not rely on tailoring or precise fits were the first ready-to-wear offerings to market. So we had things like ladies' cloaks, men's workwear, and undergarments.
Yes. And at the same time, the period of the 1840s was a period in Europe, which has been termed the Hungry 40s. And this is because successive bad harvests across Europe resulted in widespread famines. And these famines further sparked political unrest in many countries. So seeking stability, millions of Irish, English, and German working class people emigrated to the United States to stave off hunger, while their Southern and Eastern European counterparts from Italy, Poland, and Russia came fleeing persecution, often in light of the fact that they were Jewish. So between the years of 1824 and 1924, an estimated 34 million immigrants arrived in the United States, the so-called land of the free. And of course, they were all seeking employment to start anew.
And for many of these immigrants, the garment trade was an easy entry point for employment. garment manufacturing was the fastest growing segment of industry in New York during the mid-19th century, thanks to things like the invention of the sewing machine and the fact that many Eastern European Jewish immigrants in particular arrived to the United States with prior experience as tailors, dressmakers, and seamstresses in their respective homelands. And you can actually learn more about this in the book, The Huddled Masses, The Immigrant in American Society, 1880 to 1912 by Alan Kraut, who estimates that at the turn of the century, the garment trades, quote, employed roughly half of all the city's Jewish males and nearly two thirds of all Jewish wage earners.
Conditions, however, for many of these skilled artisans and makers were very different than what they may have experienced in their homelands. And that's partially because this massive influx of available labor into New York during the 19th century drove wages down because all of these new arrivals were competing to enter the workforce. So employers, as they do sometimes, were very quick to exploit immigrants' desperation to provide for themselves and their families, offering poverty-level wages and unsafe working conditions, which increased their profit margins. And friends, I just want to say that this is not a situation where it's like a one-off bad seed employer. This was rather systemic within the garment industry and largely held up by this practice known as sweating.
So there is a case study from 1893 from the New York Bureau of Labor that estimates that out of 100 women's cloak manufacturers operating in Manhattan, only half of them had assembled their own garments. The remaining half farmed out the work to contractors known as quote-unquote sweaters, who operated outside of the business's premises and hired their own laborers. Okay, this term sweaters does not refer to the fuzzy warm comfort of the cold weather garment we all know and love. In fact, it's actually the opposite. It refers to the act of making someone sweat. In 1892, the Illinois Bureau of Labor Statistics defined the practice of sweating as, quote, the farming out by competing manufacturers to competing contractors of the materials used for garments, which in turn is distributed among competing men and women to be made up.
And if this business model sounds familiar in the context of fast fashion manufacturing overseas, you would be correct, dress listeners. The model was much the same then as now, as it really relied on exploiting its own workforce. So whether then or now, when you enter these situations where there's very little oversight and very little transparency in the negotiations between each step of the supply chain, this is what opens up the door for wage exploitation and human rights abuses. And so we're not going to delve into the subject of modern day sweatshops in this episode in particular, but how were sweatshops operating and functioning at this time in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Cass, in New York?
The contractor or sweater would organize their own quote-unquote shops on the cheap in whatever space was available to them by simply installing a couple of work tables and a handful of sewing machines. Sometimes the workspace took the form of a dingy storefront or a rented basement, but perhaps even more frequently, these operations were run out of living quarters. Given that the population of New York City roughly doubled every 20 years between 1800 and 1880, which is incredible to think about it. Yes, housing recent immigrants became an exploitative endeavor for many New York City landlords who began subdividing what had once been single family homes into tiny cramped apartments, which lacked proper light, ventilation, and plumbing facilities. These types of run-down, ramshackle buildings where landlords were attempting to maximize profits at the sake of the residents' health and safety were known as tenements, which is probably familiar to many of you. And particularly, they are concentrated on Manhattan's Lower East Side. And in these neighborhoods, tenements quickly became the epicenter for immigrant life in New York City during the late 19th century.
An interesting fact here, Cass. By 1900, there were approximately 80,000 tenement buildings in New York City, where an estimated 2.3 million people resided. I had no idea. And, you know, as we noted earlier, these contract quote unquote sweaters were often operating out of living quarters. So you know what's coming next. In Louis Levine's book, Women Garment Workers, one such sweatshop employing up to a dozen people in the 1890s was described by a labor reform advocate at that time. And she said, quote, "The boss of the shop lived there with his entire family. The front room and kitchen were used as workrooms. The whole family would sleep in one dark bedroom. The sewing machines for the operators were near the windows of the front room. The basters would sit on stools near the walls, and in the center of the room, amid dirt and dust, were heaped great piles of materials. On top of the sofas, several finishers would be working.
And I also just want to say, I'm sure many people who've been to New York know that there's a fantastic museum called the Tenement Museum. I believe they do have these tenement houses curated as they would have been at the time. And I believe that they do have a tailor's home, but that's a really, really fantastic museum.
It's definitely like a living history museum where you can have like immersive experiences type thing.
Right, right. And you go to the different levels. It's really, really incredible. If you've never been there, highly recommend. And listeners, as the phrase goes, a picture paints a thousand words, and a quick Google image search for the term tenement sweatshop or a visit to our Instagram posts for this week's episodes is going to confirm what so many have written about at the time in terms of the working conditions in these spaces being not only dangerous, but also incredibly unsanitary. So you have diseases, including smallpox, tuberculosis, cholera, spreading super easy in these cramped environments. And in 1905, Annie S. Daniel, a labor reform advocate for the National Consumers League, gave a speech where she told the tale of an 8-year-old girl working in one of these sweatshops. And she says, quote, "The sick, as long as they can hold their heads up, must work to pay the cost of their living. As soon as they are recovering, they must begin again. The other day, a girl of 8 years old was dismissed from the diphtheria hospital after a severe attack of the disease. Almost immediately, she was working again."
Yes, and this might be shocking to us now, 8 years old, but child labor such as this was actually incredibly commonplace in these unregulated spaces. And it really wasn't until around 1899 that New York State passed a law that even really dealt with the matter of age and in combination with the amount of hours spent in the workplace. And at that time, a law was passed mandating that anyone under the age of 18 was not permitted to work more than 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And which is excessive, right, to us now, of course. But not even the sweaters, they didn't care. They didn't really abide by such laws because there really wasn't any oversight. And instead, many of them just kept on in their old ways, engaging child laborers, sometimes 12, 13, 14 hours a day. And in the case of a rare inspection for labor violations, they would just simply hide the children out of sight.
And this is not to say that it was only tenement sweatshops that were employing child labor, because many factories proper operated on a partial sweatshop model. So they employed their own full-time staff as well as letting sweaters organize additional labor which worked in their workrooms, including children. And this is the case at our subject at hand today, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. In her book, The Sweatshop Reform in American History, Suzanne Lawrence details the story of Pauline Newman, who began working at Triangle when she was just 12 years old. Pauline said at the time, quote, "We worked from 7:30 to 6:30 at night when it wasn't busy. When the season was on, we worked till 9 o'clock. They were the kind of employers who didn't recognize anyone working for them as a human being. They would sneak up behind you, and if you were being found talking, you would be admonished. If you kept on, you'd be fired. If you went to the toilet, you'd be threatened to be laid off for half a day and sent home at that. And that meant, of course, no pay."
And speaking of pay, this is yet another point of vulnerability for workers under this sweatshop system at the time. And the rates of pay were often manipulated by the sweaters or factory owners at their own whim. They would do this thing where they could dictate whether workers were to be paid on an hourly rate or a weekly rate versus a piece rate. And piece rates were an agreed upon wage for producing a set number of assigned pieces or garments. And for extremely capable workers who worked quickly, receiving a piece rate was preferable because they could work very, very quickly and they could make more money. However, when employers realized that it was to their advantage to switch these skilled workers to an hourly rate, all the while still expecting the exact same amount of work output, they often did this, and sometimes this could cut the maker's wages drastically up to half.
Average wages at the time hovered around $5 a week for women, which would be about $172 today. For a work week, that could be anywhere from 66 to 81 hours a week, depending on the season. Women who had specialty skills could earn more, up to around $12 per week, which was closer on par to what men made, which was an average of $17 per week or $309 today. And this wage gap was justified at the time to the different types of work male employees were given, such as cutting and floor supervision, etc. But let's face it, most employers simply paid women less because they could get away with it. Does this sound familiar to us today?
This is not to say that these weekly wages were what garment workers were actually taking home. And that is because some factory employers and sweaters instituted this totally insane fees and surcharges. Some of them were charging their employees to use the sewing machines and various other equipment that they provided, while others refused to make even partial payment for any work bearing even the tiniest, easily correctable mistake. They just would not pay them for it. And while the vast majority of these garment workers were simply in no position to risk being fired by protesting these fees, fines, and fluctuating wages, there were a select few valiant souls that did fight back against these widespread industry abuses.
And we are going to take a short sponsor break here, but when we come back, we will learn more about the efforts to unionize the New York garment industry in the years leading up to the Triangle Factory fire.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, listeners. It goes without saying that the lives of garment workers in New York City during the late 19th and early 20th centuries were not exactly easy, but their plight didn't necessarily escape notice of both social reformers inside and outside of the industry. Conditions were kind of hard to ignore given that by 1910, the garment trades employed an estimated 46% of the city's industrial labor force, which is staggering.
Yeah, and this is not an insignificant portion of the population of New York City at this time, listeners. and people began to take notice. So you have social workers, but also socialites who are involved with charity work who all began to organize around the especially vulnerable conditions for the young women in the garment industry, whose institutionalized levels of poverty, activists felt, made them susceptible to engage in prostitution in order to make ends meet. In 1903, millionaire William English Walling organized the Women's Trade Union League to, quote, assist in the organization of women wage workers into trade unions with the goal of bettering both pay and working conditions.
The female leadership of the WTUL involved both wealthy, well-educated young white women with progressive viewpoints. Actually, Eleanor Roosevelt became a member in the 1920s. Also, women activist leaders who had lived in or grown up in tenement life. However, there was yet another more grassroots organization, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which predates the founding of the WTUL by 3 years. Founded in 1900, the ILGWU, as it is most commonly known, began with 2,000 members with the goal of becoming a national organization of local unions for the workers in the ladies' garment trades.
And that could actually be its own episode just on the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, because it's such a fascinating, like, their significance within the labor rights movement. Mm-hmm. And then also many of our listeners will recognize their labels in so many of your vintage garments, so that you can actually use those labels to help you date your vintage garments. So that's really cool, too.
Yes.
But one of the ILGWU's more influential members turned leader was Clara Limlick. A young, tenacious, self-educated Jewish woman born in Ukraine in 1886, her family immigrated to the U.S. in 1903, and Clara quickly found work as a fairly well-paid draper in the Lysersen blouse factory. However, despite decent pay, money was not enough to appease Clara's socialist leanings and her fearsome spirit when it came to addressing the systemic injustices and dangerous practices she witnessed within her industry. So she joins the ILGWU in 1906, and she's really instrumental in organizing her fellow garment workers on two important strikes in 1907 and 1908 for workers' rights and wage increases before leading the charge of the seismic uprising of 20,000 in 1909.
Claire's youth and status as a fellow garment worker allowed her to move with ease within the industry. Her peers admired her greatly, and it's said that she used to use the factory owner's disinterest in their own staff and who their employees were to her advantage. She would slip in and out of factories conducting union organizing activities without the bosses even realizing that she didn't work there. And, you know, she was very popular and, you know, her passion drew people to the cause. And on November 22nd, 1909, her impassioned speech, which was delivered partially in Yiddish, at a garment organizing meeting held at the Great Hall at Cooper Union, which was attended by thousands of New York City garment workers. Well, her speech was the spark that ignited one of the largest strikes the city had ever seen.
So the day following her speech, an estimated 15,000 garment workers walked out of their factories at the appointed times and began striking on the streets. Aware of the vote the night before, many factory owners had actually requested a police presence to anticipate the walkouts. Upon exiting their places of employment to strike, thousands of garment workers, the majority of which were young women between the ages of 13 and 30, by the way, they were threatened by the officers with beatings verbally, and these officers were paid off to quell the citywide strike. So they were all clearly on the side of the heirs and not the abused employees.
Yes, they were on the take, friends. And this level of intimidation was not at all a novel concept. During the strike that she helped organize the year prior, factory owners had hired a professional boxer and a well-known mobster to beat Clara Limlick so savagely that she was hospitalized with broken ribs and contusions all over her face and body. And mind you, all of this happened while the police, quote unquote, guarding the strikers on the sidewalk watched. They didn't even make a move to intervene. But she was undeterred, being who she was, and she returned to striking on the streets just a couple days after being released from the hospital.
If this sounds a lot like the tale of the 8-year-old garment factory worker who had diphtheria and returned to work newly released from the hospital, you might not be wrong. Clara, however, always held the ethos I don't do it for myself, I do it for them. And what she did in the 1909 strike, which mobilized an estimated 15,000 garment workers, as we said, to strike for 2 solid months, would go down in history. Despite their poverty wages, thousands and thousands of garment workers held strong for their demands for increased safety precautions, a 52-hour work week, and no more than 2 hours of overtime on any given day. They also demanded the dissolution of the partial sweating system within organized factories. They wanted all employees to be allowed to be members of unions of their choice, and as such, to be paid directly by the factory or manufacturer. No more subcontractors, because obviously the more you subcontract, the less and less oversight there is.
Yeah. And also just like siphoning off the top of wages. It's just, there's no transparency there, right? Everybody was doing their different forms of negotiations. So it was very confusing at the time. So the reason that they didn't want to have subcontractors anymore was actually very clearly stated by Constance Lupp in her 1909 article entitled The Shirtwaist Maker Strike. Constance wrote, quote, "So long as there are manufacturers in the trade to employ sweated labor, they can always underbid union shops. On the other hand, employers with the best intentions who use both scab, and they're meaning non-union, and union labor, will in a rush season make demands which union members cannot accede to, and thus by degrees they must be driven out of the mixed shop."
While the strike raged on, public sympathy swelled. Lower East Side organizations held fundraisers to amass financial support, while wealthy members of the WTUL donated to the cause to keep the striking workers afloat. You had two notable supporters that included J.P. Morgan's daughter Anne Morgan and Elva Belmont, the wealthy suffragist and mother to one of the era's It Girls. And of course, we're talking about Consuelo Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. And many striking workers were provided with a $2 week allotment, far from their full salary, but at least it was something.
By February of 1910, most of the unionized garment factories had met the majority of the strikers' demands, but 150 large firms did not. And that included the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the time, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was also New York City's largest shirtwaist manufacturer. It was owned by Max Blank and Isaac Harris, the so-called shirtwaist kings. In my mind, when I read that, I'm just like imagining what cheesy like 1980s commercial that could possibly be. Because they also owned several other shirtwaist factories in the city, as well as others in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So this was a very large operation in the context of them being owners and producers. But Cass, I just realized we have actually yet to define this term, shirtwaist. Would you like to do the honors?
I would love to. So for any of our listeners who might not be familiar with the term shirtwaist, certainly not really in common parlance today, we would commonly call this garment a blouse today. And at the turn of the 20th century, the combination of a shirtwaist, also sometimes referred to as a waist, was worn with a full-length skirt. And this is really the core of most women's wardrobes, regardless of class. And they were in incredibly high demand, as most women owned several. And it is estimated that at the turn of the 20th century, there was approximately 500 shirtwaist factories in Manhattan alone, which employed approximately 40,000 workers just creating shirtwaists. Mm-hmm. And 75% of these workers were women.
Yeah. And that's not the rest of the garment trades. That's just making blouses, which is incredible. Also incredible is that on any given day, the Triangle Factory could employ between 500 and 600 workers, depending on the season, and also how many quote-unquote sweaters were sending their contract workers to work on the Triangle premises, because it was one of those like mixed operations. And the factory occupied three full floors of the Ash Building in Lower Manhattan, which remains today at the intersection of Green Street and Washington Place, just off Washington Square Park. And the Triangle workrooms were on the 8th and 9th floors, while the corporate offices occupied the 10th. And this arrangement of workers, workrooms, and who was where when would ultimately determine the fate of Triangle Shirtwaist Factory employees on Saturday, March 25th, 1911, which is a day that has gone down not only in New York City history, but also in American history at large.
And certainly fashion history as well. So
yes.
Dress listeners, having given an overview of the New York City garment trade at the turn of the century, We are going to end part one of our two-part conversation here. On Friday, we will be back with the tragic tale of the fire itself and hear from some of the survivors in their own words. But that does it for us today. May you consider the hundreds, if not thousands, of hands represented in your closet next time you get dressed.
As always, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can email us at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also DM us at @dressed_podcast, which is where we post images to accompany each week's episodes. If you would like to search for our Instagram content related to this week's episodes, you can search for the hashtags 352 and 353. That's #dressed352 and #dressed353. Dress listeners, we only have a few weeks left until our newest Dressed School of Fashion offering launches, which is the Great Designer Series. That very first class, taught by me, is going to be on April 6th. This is going to be a 4-part class entitled American Fashion's Innovators and Icons. That's part one. There's going to be a second 4-part class to that as well. But you can learn lots more and register over at dressedhistory.com, which is where you can also sign up for one of my ongoing private fashion history tours of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And these have been super, super fun so far. Lots of dress listeners have been coming, and I will be opening up expanded offerings of tours like this in the spring.
Yes, and it should be said that you do make exceptions if people want to bring their own group. You will do times outside of what you have scheduled and available on the website. So just reach out.
Send me an email and I'm happy to organize that for you guys.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I do also want to say that April's class, unlike my What Women Wore to the Revolution class, which is just once a month, April's class is actually offered every Saturday in the month of April. So for those of you who can't wait a month to get your fashion history, I think that's really, really cool that you're doing that every week, April.
And also, too, we've gotten a lot of emails from people being like, oh, I can't make Saturdays. Yes, absolutely. We are going to send it out recordings. So you guys can still take the class, just not sit in the live version of it, because we will email the recordings of the class so you can still participate.
Yeah, and I have a lot of people who do that in What Women Wore to the Revolution, so it works well for everybody. And you know what else we are offering in addition to dress classes, dress listeners? Our dress bookshelf. Head on over to bookshop.org/shop/dress, or you can find the link in our show notes to check out 120 of our favorite and featured fashion history titles. And we love the fact that bookshop.org works with independent booksellers to source their offerings. Also, you know you can listen to Dressed ad-free for just $3 a month. You can skip the ads, and you can also find a link to that in our show notes or in the link tree in our Instagram to subscribe to the exclusive content version of the show, which is ad-free. And I do just want to say that we are talking about at some point this year expanding our exclusive content, so stay tuned.
Mm-hmm. There might have been a little Patreon meeting situation that happened recently. We're still hashing out the details of what that might be. I've only been doing Dressed full-time now for a couple of weeks. So we're trying to figure it out. We're figuring it out, friends. But thank you, as always, for tuning in. And more Dressed coming your way on Friday. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.